This is Spectator Radio. If you'd like to subscribe to The Spectator, you can get 12 issues for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Just go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello, and welcome to The Spectator's Books Podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator, and in this week's podcast, I'm joined by Ursula Buchan, who will be well known to many readers of the magazine as a superb writer on gardening. But this time, we're talking about her work as a biographer. Her new book is a biography of her grandfather, John Buchan, and it's called Beyond the 39 Steps. Welcome, Ursula.
Very nice to be here. Thank you for asking me, Sam.
Well, the first, and I hope it won't seem an impertinent question to ask, is where, you know, what made you think, I'd like to write a biography of John Buchan? Because, of course, there are a few in existence. Was this an act of grand filial piety? Or
no, really not. But there hadn't been one for 25 years. And I was, about a few years ago, I decided to have, you know, when all the sort of whirlwind of career making and child rearing is over, I decided to read the canon, or as much of it as I could find.
And there's a lot of it.
And there's a lot of it, more than 100 books, more than 1,000 articles, many of them, of course, for The Spectator. And I read lots of things I'd never read before. I'd read the short stories, but not for a long time. The war poetry I'd never read. I'd never read The Political Thought, and I certainly hadn't read the legal textbook. And I hadn't read all the serious biographies of Walter Scott, Cromwell. I had read Montrose, but years and years before. So anyway, my thoughts became more insistent that he was beginning to become just the junior partner of the great Alfred Hitchcock. People knew him really only as the man who wrote the 39 Steps, and not even spelt the right way, with numbers, not letters.
Yes.
That seemed to me to be, you know, just completely unfair. I mean, you know, innovative as the 1935 Hitchcock film was, there was just so much more to John Buchan. And so I decided to write another history, not a work of literary criticism, but definitely trying to explain why it was that he was such a figure before the war. A man who, when he died in 1940, in February 1940, during the Phoney War, while he was in harness, while he was Governor General of Canada, the editor of the Times said he had never received so many letters of sorrow, really, from the general public after a public figure had died. So it seemed to me that everything was out of print. Everything biographical was out of print. The Janet Adam Smith 1965 biography, my father's memoir of 82, Andrew Loney's excellent Presbyterian Cavalier in 95. It was time to reintroduce him, really, to another generation.
To bring back. Now, as you say, he was a huge figure in his own lifetime. I wonder what sort of figure he was, you know, as you were growing up. Obviously, he was sort of a family figure. You didn't know him yourself. You knew his widow, Susie. You know, what was your sort of apprehension of him, and how did that differ, if you like, from the sort of outside idea of Buchan?
Well, I wasn't really terribly conscious of him until the age of 10, when my twin sister and I went to the local village hall to play bingo for the first time. And I know this is a ridiculous memory, but we both have it. So I don't think it's a false one. And we were fascinated by the man taking the numbers out of the bag and saying, you know, 11 legs, 11, and then 39 all the steps. And we were astonished that this book that had been published, I don't know, 50 years before, and was really something to do with our family, that's, you know, we knew about him but not much, was famous enough. You know, his best book was famous enough, or best known book was famous enough to be a bingo call. And that's really when it struck me that this man had a sort of public persona. It wasn't just a family thing.
And but how was he seen in the family? I mean, was he a great sort of exemplar, with people always talking about him? Were they saying, you know, he was this? Because, well, he obviously seems to have been a good egg. I mean, was he seen as a sort of?
Yes, and our grandmother, who was the matriarch of the family, she was doing all she could to keep his memory green at a time when he was thoroughly out of fashion after the Second World War. But my father and mother were divorced when I was small, and my mother had never known him. She didn't meet my father till after the war. So we had the second-hand stories that she'd heard from my father, but not very much. The books were on the shelf, and we were very much encouraged to read them. The first one I read, actually, was The Three Hostages, which begins with that lovely sort of pastoral scene in Oxfordshire, which, of course, I knew, because I lived in Oxfordshire too. And so I was off, really, after that. But, there were certain family stories, but until I read Janet Adam Smith's biography, I really didn't know a lot about him.
Yeah. I mean, you talk at one point early in the book about saying that in the process of researching this, there was a sort of crump sound of myths collapsing. Which made the biggest crumps?
Jan Smuts firing five times at him in South Africa. He was a trooper for a short time. When he was a colonial administrator, he was called out from time to time with the Rand rifles when there was guerrilla warfare around. They were protecting Johannesburg towards the end of the Second Boer War. And the story was that they were ambushed by a Boer commando and Smuts fired five times as they galloped away. Well, that's all very well, but Smuts wasn't around near Johannesburg at the material time. So they became good friends, Smuts and John Bracken, during the First World War. Smuts, obviously, commanding some of the South African forces, and John Bracken, wartime director of propaganda, but I don't believe that they had anything to do with each other in South Africa. So that's just one, yeah.
Now, I mean, you've given it the title of Beyond the 39 Steps, and as you say, he's sort of remembered, when he is remembered now for this.
I had to call it that.
You had to have the word 39 Steps at the time, of course. But there is such a colossal sort of hinterland. As you say, there's 100 books or so, and he wrote, but also he had a kind of career in public life,
he was deputy editor of The Spectator for a bit.
He was deputy editor of The Spectator for a bit. Assistant editor, wasn't he?
Was it assistant? Yes.
Assistant editor.
Yes, I think you'll probably
know. And our was very key to it. She said, if you've got Ursula, and you must ask her what he did for us.
I'd have to check.
Unclear.
He did for St. Lo Strachey. While he was a barrister, he paid for his, really for his training by writing for The Spectator and other periodicals. And
so that's when we paid better.
Possibly. And when St. Lo Strachey, who actually had some political ambitions, when he was away or he was going to Queen Victoria's funeral, that sort of thing, he was quite a public figure, Strachey. JB would deputise for him. But I think a chap called Charles Graves actually was the deputy editor, and JB assisted. We all call him JB. The families always call him JB. And I call him JB in the book, actually. Yeah. Assisted Charles Graves. Charles Graves was rather an interesting man, actually. He wrote a lot for Punch. During the First World War, he had a sort of genius for comic verse. And I quote his verse about, or part of it, about John Buchan when at The Spectator, which is quite fun. He's very, very funny. So it was a small organisation, Spectator then, but it was a very happy one. But when he married, he needed really to earn more money. So he gave up The Spectator, except he continued to contribute, but he was no longer a salaried employee. And went to work for Thomas Nelson & Son, the publishers, with offices in Edinburgh and London. He worked in London. That was a more sort of regular form of income, really. But he continued to write for The Spectator, really, actually, on and off all his life.
But this sort of, if the centre of gravity of his life, maybe you'll say this, was the writing. Is that something that went on? Sort of dismayingly. I think his first novel was published before he went up to Oxford, wasn't it? Or thereabouts.
Yes, Sir Quixote of the Moors, which you may not have read, came out
in
1895.
I'm afraid I'm researching this podcast, I haven't had time to read Sir Quixote of the Moors.
It's about Covenanters in 17th century Scotland. Yes, and another one came out in 1900. He started very, very early. In fact, he even had a Who's Who entry when he was at Oxford, where his occupation was put as undergraduate. So he was making a splash, even in his Oxford days.
And he was writing constantly through his life. I mean, I think there's some description again in his Oxford days where he says, well, I'm pretty idle. You know, I get about 10 hours work done during the day and then I'm just lying around drinking cider.
Yes, I mean, yes, quite. I mean, it was a very monastic existence in Oxford in the last years of the 19th century, I think. So they weren't distracted by girls much because they just weren't there.
Though his high-mindedness, there's a couple of touching stories about how, you know, he's sitting in his room, you know, doing something scholarly, and this kind of crowd of rowdies. It reminded me of the beginning of Decline and Fall. Furniture upside down and demand whiskey. He's sort of baffled.
Yes, quite. But he even then, he had charm and wit. He would not have attracted the likes of Raymond Asquith and Tommy Nelson and people like that if he hadn't had rather more to him than the sort of dour Scots, you know, sort of scholar. The key to me, to the reason why he both wrote and had a public life, is his religious convictions. It wasn't enough for him to be in an ivory tower. And I do say somewhere, I mean, I may be wrong, that I think that if he had just concentrated on writing, he might have written a great novel, which he never did. But he never gave it the prominence, particularly with the thrillers, actually, which he wrote very quickly, and sometimes you could see they're written very, very quickly. But he didn't feel that he would be doing good in the world just by writing.
Do you think he was annoyed in any way that the thrillers, I mean, I'm sure he was pleased that they brought him, you know, money and fame and success, but was he annoyed in a way that was what drew down so much of the attention on it? I mean, that those were what lived. I mean, I think you described saying towards the end of his life, you say, you know, had he lived, he would have continued writing, you know, shockers for relaxation, serious histories for his legacy.
Yes.
You know, that he was thinking
yes.
about his legacy being serious histories,
oh, yes,
but they aren't. You know, I mean,
no.
During his lifetime, did he have that sense and was he vexed by it?
I don't think he was vexed. He was rarely vexed. I think he was pleased that they made him money, and also I think he quite liked the fame, but it didn't really worry him that his people liked him for his novels. Actually, in one talk he gave, or it might have, I can't remember whether it's something he wrote, but he said, you know, I write to interest and amuse myself, and therefore I must confuse my readers who expect. You know, every year they buy my latest novel before they go on their summer holidays. And it must bemuse them that they think they're going to have a Hanny story and they have a Dixon McCann story or they have a historical novel. Because he was suiting himself.
Yeah, so he wasn't writing to the market in a cynical way.
Well, he knew what the market was. His work as literary editor for Thomas Nelson gave him a very good appreciation of what public taste was like. But he was still suiting himself. He would go on these enormously long walks and the plots would come to him and then he'd come home and, you know, write them down at dictation speed very often.
Only Barbara Cartland had that trick, otherwise.
Yes.
One thing you say that's, I think, intriguing, you know, people who look for him in the characters, you say, you know, people think, identify Hanny with Buchan. He's absolutely not, because, you know, Hanny's much coarser, more...
Yeah,
you know,
robust, sort of colonial, yes. Yeah.
And Edward Leithen, you say very definitely, and is not Buchan either.
He's more like. I think Leithen probably is the slightly desiccated bachelor lawyer who discovers in the end in the last book, Sick Heart River.
Do you call his best book?
One of his best. Though J.B. didn't know he was dying then, he was probably living sub specie aeternitatis. His duodenal ulcer was getting worse and worse. Rudyard Kipling had died of a burst duodenal ulcer in 1936. He knew it could happen to him at any time. So he is...
He lived with that for a long time.
Yes, 30 years. Most of his adult life. And it's one of the reasons why he is such a remarkable person. Because most people, if they feel sick and their tummy aches all the time, don't do what he did. And in those days, nobody knew what to do about it. I mean, he had an operation in 1917 to bypass. Didn't work, really. But nowadays, antibiotics cure these ulcers pretty quickly. But you know, there weren't antibiotics. So I can't remember what the question was.
Was to do with how much he put himself... I mean, actually, he put his ulcer into a character in Greenmantle, didn't he?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes, yes. So that's, yes, John S. Lencarin, who was a rather sort of likeable, Bible-quoting American who seems to change his job all the time. He's either a spy or he's a businessman or he does all sorts of things. He also plays patients, which J.B. did as well. So you know, his characters have aspects of him, but they aren't him. They're not autobiographical, I don't think.
And what was his character? You've talked about the importance of his religion. Was this a sort of, as you say, one of the biographies called, you know, Presbyterian? Did his extraordinary work ethic come from that, do you think?
I think it must have done. I think the key, well, for me, the key to John Buchan is in his childhood and youth. Born in Perth, but at age 3 months, his father was called to a free kirk in Parthed, which is an industrial parish next to Kirkcaldy on the Fife coast. Then when he's 13, his father is called to the John Knox Church in the Gorbals in Glasgow, which in the end of the 19th century was one of the worst slums in Europe. And JB went to school in the Gorbals. So... And he was part of a, you know, a loving and intelligent, well-read family. But they were, you know, all the talk was of, you know, church work and sales of work and Sabbath schools. And they went to church 3 times on Sunday. And, you know, it was just his landscape. And so, and all his, his brothers were similarly affected, really. One brother was a very hard-working Indian civil servant who came back with some horrible thing from on leave, age 32, and died in Glasgow. And
is that Willie?
That was Willie.
Yeah.
And Walter was the town clerk and procurator fiscal of Peebles for decades. So they, you know, they had the work ethic, all of them. But
Buchan was a Scot who spent most of his life outside Scotland, though, wasn't he? Did he take Scotland with him a bit?
Very much. I mean, he always said he had Scotland at the back of his head. And he did. And when he died, the Canadians thought he would be buried in Scotland. But in fact, he wasn't. He was buried in the village where he lived near Oxford, Elsfield. But yes, and he goes on writing Scottish characters all through his life. And Sir Walter Scott, which I think he, you know, Montrose, those biographies. They, you know, he was trying to explain Scotland to everybody else.
Yeah, and in literary terms, you write that, you know, when he was growing up, sort of Scott and Stevenson were the
crucial. And Burns,
yeah.
Of course. And his father was a very interesting man, actually. He was a great storyteller. And he knew all the border ballads, whether they'd been published or not. And J.B. had this really serious accident when he was 5 years old. He fell out of a carriage and the back wheel went over his head. And that's why in all the photographs you can see this enormous bump on his forehead, which came from this accident. And he spent several months, I don't know exactly how long, but possibly as long as a year, in bed, not being able to do anything. And I feel certain his father sat with him and told him stories and sang to him and all of that. And also, I mean, both Stevenson and Scott spent quite a lot of their childhoods as invalids. And it seems to me quite likely that imaginative children become more imaginative as a result of that enforced idleness.
Yes. Also, it suggested maybe that Buchan, you know, so much as you write, what drove Buchan's fiction was a sense of landscape and place. I mean, you know, whether it be the Hindu Kush or the Scottish Lowlands, it was...
Particularly the borders, because his mother came from Upper Tweedale and they spent all their summer holidays there. And it's hugely important and formative for him, those holidays when they got away from the smoke of Glasgow and they fished and he walked everywhere and got to know the shepherds. His two uncles were farmers, three uncles were farmers. sheep farmers of, you know, of some standing. So you got to know all the shepherds, and you see that a lot in his early short stories and writings. And he never lost them. In 1934, I think he told the no doubt bemused MPs in Parliament that he would rather take the opinion of a Scottish shepherd than all the you know the government heads of Europe, which they must have thought what, but he sort of meant it really. He thought there was a kind of deep knowledge and understanding inherent in these unlettered. They're not completely unlettered, but these men who lived in the open air, in this extraordinary landscape, who read only the Bible, but had were interested in liberal politics, had these qualities that pastoral landscape gave them. That's really why he never loses this sense of the Scottish landscape.
Yeah, I want to ask a bit about his relationship with his wife, because that was obviously hugely important, and there's the chapters in which you describe their courtship, it's, you know, to somebody of the, you know, my generation or below, was sort of almost fabulously chaste and
yes,
traditional.
I mean, there's quite a lot simmering underneath,
yes,
actually.
But it was a love match, wasn't it?
It was. It definitely was. One thing I did grow up with was, I think, an unfair sense that it was a matter of calculation, him marrying into the English aristocracy.
Because he wasn't posh, obviously.
Absolutely not, no.
He ended up Lord Tweedsmuir, but...
Yes, but through his own efforts, in fact. But that by marrying Susie, that the whole of the ruling class, pre-war ruling class, was open to him. Well, that was certainly true, but he was in his early 30s. He was already very much in that milieu. He wouldn't have met her otherwise, actually. And what's fascinating about the courtship, and I particularly enjoyed, really, especially as I had a lot of new material to work on, a whole lot of letters that turned up in a cousin's cupboard, which were fantastically useful from this point of view.
Which was used as a was this their love letters?
No, really, letters between Willie and India and home is the difficulties there were over the marriage. And they didn't come from the Grosvenors and the Stuart Wortleys and all these sort of, you know, aristocratic contacts, relations of Susie. They came from his mother, who thought that him marrying a aristocratic English Anglican was just the end.
Yeah, she wrote it, you quote a rather slightly, not quite snotty, but distinctly reserved letter that she wrote him wrote her future daughter-in-law on their engagement.
Absolutely, and it was thanks to Susie that after their first child was born, Alice, the year after they were married, that Susie was prepared to allow her mother-in-law in on all of that. And that's when the thaw really happened. And it says a lot for Susie that she recognised that this was the way to do it. And they became firm friends, actually, and Susie was very good to her. She wasn't a very easy woman, but she had...
Helen wasn't an easy woman.
But she had sterling qualities, but she was rather narrow-minded, really. But yes, I very much enjoyed writing about the wedding, too. Nobody'd ever bothered to write about the wedding before, but it was in all the newspapers, and there were drawings of her outfits and a list of their wedding presents and who was at the wedding. I mean, it was straight, and it was St George's, Hanover Square, so it absolutely was straight out of Vanity Fair, and a book that JB very much enjoyed. So I think he will have smiled wryly about, you know, the fact that he was in Vanity Fair. Yeah, that was fun. I enjoyed that.
And you know, as you've said, I think before we started this recording, you said, people are always saying to me, you know, where are the skeletons in the closet? Did he have affairs? Did he? But he doesn't seem to have. There doesn't seem to have been anything other than what it looks like.
That's right. And I do think that people find that a bit frustrating. But I can't conjure this out of the air. There is no evidence. I mean, admittedly, people were very, very much more reticent in letters and all the rest of it. But there really is no sort of, as it were, collateral evidence that he strayed in any way. Why should he particularly? I mean, it's not necessary for the creative spirit. You know?
She had a very long widowhood, of course.
She did.
I mean, one of the poignant bits in the book is your description of your increased acquaintance with your grandmother when you got old enough to drive and go and see her. You know, what was she like? And how, you say she didn't talk all that much about JB.
No. Well, she was is obvious in the book, she was a reticent person in a reticent age. And I think the gap between us was just too great. But that wasn't to say that she didn't take an interest in me. And she was very kind to me. My mother died when I was 15, and I really needed a sort of cheerleader. And she was very good at that. She wasn't like anybody else's granny I'd ever met, because, you know, she talked about German poetry and that sort of thing. She would send me her memoirs, and she talked about knowing H.G. Wells and Arnold Bennett and all these people. So, as I say, she wasn't like anybody else's granny, but she was very kind to me and very encouraging. She hadn't gone to university, and her formal education was decidedly sketchy. And so, though she was very well read, she felt the lack. And my eldest half-sister went to Harvard, and then I went to Cambridge. And you could tell that was a source of satisfaction to her, that the women in the family were doing just as well as the men.
That's good. The other thing she felt the lack of was JB. The same, you say, I can't remember the phrase you used, but more or less that the stuffing had been knocked out of her by his death.
Yes, I couldn't think of a more elegant expression than that. But I think that
I think you
was
did on a slightly more elegant expression. That would be much more elegant.
I mean, I have known people who could not talk about somebody they've lost, not 10, 20, 30, 50 years afterwards. And I think she was probably one of those, that their life together had been so interesting and exciting, and she will have felt that they were often in the sort of thick of things. I mean, he was spectator and actor in many of the great dramas of the first half of the 20th century, including the abdication crisis and the toings and froings after Munich. His friends, he stayed with Roosevelt at the White House. He was the first British man, Britain ever to address both houses of Congress. You know, she had lived a fascinating life with him. Admittedly, you know, it had its downsides, particularly Government House in Ottawa could be pretty constraining. But, you know, when she lost, he was only 64 when he died. I mean, it's phenomenal, isn't it? He did all that in 64 years. And she had, I think, more than 30 years of widowhood. And it must have just felt like a sort of coda to a life rather than a real life.
Yeah. Speaking of codas, you mentioned Canada and the, you know, Government House in Ottawa not being the centre of things. And, you know, when he went to be Governor General of Canada, he was expected to stop writing and publishing and having films. Do you think he obviously responded quite, he described Canada as, you know, a country of the larger air, you know, he was kind of quite excited, and he said, you know, it's a lovely line in his letter of his sort of pros and cons, you know, an immediate peerage might revive mother.
yes.
You know, there were advantages to his going to Canada. But was it, do you think, exactly, I mean, was it a sort of backwater after what he'd been doing and being in the thick of it?
I think sometimes he felt like that. He said he felt like an 18th century laird in Sutherland, in Scotland, while, you know, Burke and Fox are slogging it out in the House of Commons, and the revolution's going on in France. But things did happen in Canada, and particularly his connections with Roosevelt, where he wasn't completely out of the swim. But most of his diplomacy was done behind the scenes, and I don't think we'll ever know entirely how much. Some academics think that he was really quite important in the sort of American, Canadian, British sort of triangle after his influence, even after the Second World War. But it's impossible to know, because so much of it is not written down.
And do you think, I mean, you've said you think if he'd concentrated just on his writing, he might have written, I mean, he's got a line somewhere about the you know, extraordinary, hard, difficult dedication. I think I'll dig it out. I think it's a "No man can hope to be a great writer save by the restraint, the pains, the hard and bitter drudgery of his art." And you know, as you've said, you think because he didn't quite give himself to that entirely, he never wrote as great a novel as, or as great a book as he might have. Do you feel similarly with public life? Had, you know, do you think he achieved all that he could have potentially achieved in public life?
No, but I think that his personality was such that he was never going really to go all the way, in politics particularly. His elbows weren't sharp, and though you don't have to have sharp elbows to succeed, it certainly helps. He never got around him a sort of a gang that had to be, you know, of politicians that had to be sort of appeased by office. He fatally saw the other chap's point of view much too easily. I mean, one of his closest associates in the House of Commons was a chap called Jimmy Maxton, who was one of the so-called Red Clydesiders, who'd been in prison during the First World War for stirring up dissent in the shipyards, you know, but they happened to go to the same school in the Gorbals, and they remained friends. So, you know, that kind of lack of partisanship. And he was also...
Some would see it as a virtue of character, at least.
Yes, like, certainly of character. And he was also MP for the Scottish Universities, which was, you know, he hadn't really had to climb up all the way up the greasy pole. That was, you know, you just, you know, under, graduates who had two votes until 1948, amazingly. And so all he did was write an election address and the sort of postal ballots came in. So it wasn't the sort of rough and tumble of normal politics. And I think quite a lot of politicians thought that he was a bit Olympian, frankly. And, you know, his speeches in Parliament were pretty cerebral, really. I mean, he's a great stylist, both as a writer and a speaker, but, he wasn't really an orator, and he certainly didn't... He didn't have that kind of sort of passion for it, I think. I think partly because he had so many other interests. But, he felt he'd serve. You know, he did a lot of good work as well. Pilgrim Trust, for instance, he was one of the founding trustees of the Pilgrim Trust, which still survives doing brilliant work. And also, he was one of the founder governors of the British Film Institute. Even before he met Hitchcock. He was already speaking in Parliament about the importance of some kind of organisation, not government-run, that could archive films and could teach people how to make films and all of that. And, of course, the BFI goes from strength to strength as well. So these were good, worthy projects, but they weren't going to get him into the cabinet.
Well, that's maybe a lack of vanity in him, do you think?
Well, he wasn't without vanity. He could never quite let go of the fact that he had come a very long way. And those of us who haven't had to come as far perhaps don't understand what that's like. You know, Smeaton Road in Parthed was, well, it's now a post-industrial wasteland, but it was never very glamorous. And that's where he spent his childhood, you know, and then, of course, Glasgow. And so I think the fact that though Canada didn't want him to go with a peerage, George V wasn't having any of that, I think he was pleased that it was a public sign. But he was probably also just as pleased as getting the Companionship of Honour in 1932, because that was the sign that he'd made it as a writer.
You're entitled to be pleased with the CH.
I think so.
Can I end by just asking you, I guess, a sort of straightforward question? If, you know, we know that still, to a certain extent, he's out of fashion.
Not as much as the 50s and 60s, where people were pretty snarky about him, actually.
Because he was a relic of a sort of,
yes,
pre-war imperialist.
Absolutely, Edwardian. He was wrongly accused of anti-Semitism. And I really do think I nailed that in the book. I don't know what you think, but the evidence really is that he was a philo-Semite at a time when... having Jews.
So somebody has said a philo-Semite is an anti-Semite who likes Jews.
Well, let's not get into labels. Shall we? But yeah, all I know is that he worked on Jews' behalves, both in this country and by publicising the plight of German Jews in the early 30s. He didn't do his own political ambitions any good, because there were elements of anti-Semitism in the Tory party in the 30s. So, you know, if he wanted to get on, he should have left the Jewish question alone.
Yeah. What I was going to say is he's out of fashion, maybe not so much as in the 60s. If you were trying to sell him to a millennial or somebody, you know, a literate person in their 20s, you know, and you were saying this, you know, this is why you should read Buchan and this is what you should read, what would you, after, of course, your own excellent book, what would you press on them? What would you say is the point of entry for somebody who wants to know what Buchan was all about?
The thing about even his lightest fiction, there's a deep, serious purpose to it, which is informed by his religious convictions. He knew that there was a battle of good and evil in the world, and it was nip and tuck. And in that way, his books are like Tolkien or, you know, or J.K. Rowling or anybody else. The battle between good and evil forces goes on, and he was dealing with that as a subject, really, or rather, that it's behind even his light-hearted fiction, possibly not John McNabb, but most of them anyway. And that never dates, I don't think. He tells a rattling good story. I mean, you know, even if, you know, it's a bit dated sometimes and, you know, people use expressions that we don't use now and all the rest of it, they're unputdownable. So, you know, I...
Well, my grandfather pressed Buchan on me as a teenager and I absolutely...
And which did you start with? And
I think I did start with the 39 Steps, but I did the Hostages and Green Mantle and, you know...
Yes, Mr. Stamfast and John McNabb and they all have a sort of esprit about them, which is very attractive. So it doesn't really matter where you start.
So publishers... Bring them back into print, and readers stop by reading Ursula's book.
A surprising number are in print, actually. 39 Steps has never been out of print, but I'm not sure Greenmantle has either. But no, there's plenty, and you can download the whole lot, the whole works. And I think for people who've read the thrillers but want to go a bit further, then the complete works is where you should start, with the short stories, particularly some of the poetry, the historical fiction, that sort of thing. Historical fiction really doesn't date, and his historical imagination was extraordinary.
Ursula Buchan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You were listening to the Spectator's Books podcast. Very much hope you enjoyed it, and if you did, please do consider rating or reviewing us on the iTunes store. We'd love to hear from you.